Tonight I wanted to talk about something that is has some importance to me. Again, just on a personal note, it's been about 25 years now that I've been standing up and talking to people. Many, many years ago, a woman asked me if I would do it, having never talked to more than my wife about things. And it's sort of gone on. So after this time, it starts to, you know, dawn on me that there are certain sort of recurring themes. There's really a small band of subjects that are truly important. There's a lot of things we can talk about, a lot of information we can share, but in terms of what it is that is going to facilitate some sort of inner change within us and within the world around us, there really are only a very few things that are of deep importance. And so, you know, more and more, I find myself talking about less and less. But tonight, what I want to talk about really is something that that I see happening, and something that probably we all see, that at this particular moment, there's something that's going on. I'm calling it a convergence, where there are certain things that seem to be coming together, certain streams of influence that are seemingly coming together in many ways. So a convergence of wisdoms is what the subject matter is. But along with that, there are other sorts of convergences occurring as well. And I think all of these things are linked together. One of the things that we are most familiar with is that for whatever reason, it does seem that right now there is also a convergence of what we might describe as very pressing problems in the world in which we live. I mean, everybody gets that. And if you start to tick off the list of things that we find ourselves confronted with at the moment, it can be one of those things that if you don't have a deeper view, it might make you a little bit depressed. You know, environmental degradation is one of those things that we're all seeing. You know, whether we call it pollution of the air, the land, the seas, huge problem that's going on around the world. You know, you have an increasing spread of deserts in the world. What used to be fertile land, deserts are expanding exponentially at the moment. The seas are being fished. Every time you turn on the TV or open a newspaper, I mean, today I took about 30, 45 minutes, and for the first time in a long time, I read through a newspaper, front to back. I mean, really, it was a wonderful experience, but it was also one of those things that pointed to, you know, this is just today's crop of specific issues that were being addressed. And, you know, part of the crop we have is this explosion again of there are people in the world who have, for various reasons, the many wars that are being fought, the sort of economic imbalances that you see in the world, have had to leave their countries. So you have this condition where more than at any time since the Second World War, you have 50 million people who are without a country because of, you know, the conditions, man-made, that have driven them from their homes. If you put all those people into one country, it would be the 24th most populous country in the world. A country of people who have no country. So that's just one of the things. But you know, go down the list and you find that there are any number of things that are just looming out there. So that's a fact. But then when you ask yourself the question, you know, why is it that these things are as they are? When just the fact of it is that there is knowledge enough about every one of these problems for it to be solved. You know, it's no mystery about ways to reduce the pollution of the atmosphere, the mining of the seas. There's no mystery there. There are technologies, there is knowledge aplenty to address each and every one of these things. So, that we know. So obviously, since when we look at the news and we see that not only has that problem stayed, but it has magnified, probably if we're intelligent people, we ask another question. And that question would be, why, in the face of a situation where there is sufficient knowledge to address these problems, why are they not solved? And the further question would be, what is it about simple knowledge that it's not sufficient to provide a solution? Is there something that lies beyond knowledge as we've come to regard it? And I think that's sort of the realm that I want to speak to this evening. You know, what is it, when we say the word knowledge, what is it, first of all, that we mean? There's a quote that Albert Einstein said, and others have said similar things, that's going to kind of run through what I'm talking about this evening. The quote that he said was that, it may end up being just a paraphrase, but there is no problem that can be solved on the level on which it was created. So a problem created at a certain level cannot be solved at that level. So problems that are based on misuses of knowledge are not necessarily corrected by a different use of knowledge. It's all kind of one level. But we'll talk about that. So probably, just to kind of lay out how we might go about this, it would probably be best for us to have some sort of sense of the terms that I'll be using, the terms that we throw around and we think that when we say them, when I say it, because you recognize the word, it means the same thing to you, which often is not the case. And often that's one of the sources of a lot of problems between people. We think that we're saying something that's communicating, but somebody else has a different meaning. So this whole level of what is it that we're talking about when we use the word knowledge is what's going to be important for us this evening. So for me, the way I would categorize it is, I would say that there is a hierarchy. You could say a hierarchy in this whole field of knowledge. At the low end of the spectrum, you have what we would call information. You know, the time that we're living in has been described as the information age. We're awash in information, and nobody can process it all. Information is just those, basically you could call it facts, just those little building blocks of things. You know, it is information that this shirt is blue. It's information that, you know, this is a certain type of light. You know, those are things that are informative. They're neutral. They have no particular, there's no particular value to any one of those. You combine all of these various different types of information, and then you start to get something that takes on the characteristic of knowledge. Knowledge is a structure, a specific way of structuring information. So you have whole realms of knowledge. Everything, you know, a tailor who sews has a certain knowledge base of the fabrics, of the color, of the way they stretch, of the way they feel, of how they breathe, how they drape. There's a whole body of knowledge that's required to be a tailor, and it's composed of all these different little pieces of information. So, information, then you get the whole kind of concept base, which we call knowledge. But then there's a level beyond that. And that level would generally be described as something along the line of understanding. So, understanding is something of a very different sort than just knowledge. I mean, it's one thing to know that, you know, certain people perhaps don't get along, or it's one thing to know that there are problems with the way that we deal with the oceans and the waters and the land and the sea. That's knowledge. But understanding is something of a much more expansive character. And it's something that generally falls outside of our normal realm of conversation. Because when we understand, it's something where we perceive a greater pattern. It is what assigns meaning. So knowledge takes on a very, very different quality in the light of understanding. From a theosophical point of view, we would say that understanding is a quality of the intuition. Buddhi is the technical term that's used. So, and it's a lot like, you know, light. You sit in a darkened room. All of us will be here, the same arrangement of the chairs, the same arrangements of the furniture. Nothing's particularly different, but our ability to perceive the pattern and the layout, we don't have it until some sort of light shines. And that's what that's an example of what I might call understanding. Wisdom is something of a completely different character. If I were to describe wisdom, I would really just say it is the perception of reality, of what is, in all of its various seen and unseen qualities. It's the characteristic of what people describe as enlightenment. So there's this hierarchy. Information at the bottom, knowledge, understanding, wisdom. We tend to fall in this kind of general range of information and knowledge. That's the world we operate in, and it's what pervades our way of thinking at the moment, which is the problem. So, you know, just to give you an example, sometimes when I'm talking about this whole information, knowledge example, I'll use the example of a vase or of a bottle or a container of some sort. Information is the material that you use to provide the structure for the vase or for the bottle. You know, each particular vase has a different shape. You know, so the field of biology looks a certain way. Christianity, which is another knowledge base, has its look. Theosophy, you know, theosophists tend to think that the shape of the theosophical vessel is, you know, more like a Coke bottle, perhaps. It has that more like sexy appeal to it. You know, it's got curves. It's, you know, but everybody thinks that about their particular field. So information, knowledge provides the structure, but then the question arises of what is it there for? You know, you've created this vessel for what? And obviously it's created to contain something. And in the absence of that, it's just, you know, it's just another thing. So the thing that it's there to contain, you could say would be the waters of understanding, the waters of wisdom, is what we create this for. And so the whole process described in you know, the realm of spiritual practice is this idea that we have to study to develop this sort of view and this structure, but that then there's a subject of meditation where the study creates the vessel, the meditation is the thing that opens our understanding so that the water can then flow and this vessel becomes usable. So, you know, that's sort of the dynamic. Often, there is this idea that many people express that there is this difference, that we live in a world of illusion, and that there is, in fact, a world that could be described as real. There is that beyond what we see that is real. And very often, this is sort of what you hear. And I'd say that it's something that is true, and it's not true, in the sense that everything, you know, that we see and that we experience at this particular level, you know, if you stick yourself with a pin, that's not an illusion. The pain that you feel is not unreal. Certainly it's real. But it's a rather partial way that we perceive the world. So, you know, it's as if I burn my finger, the experience is that everything in my attention starts to become the tip of this finger that aches, that hurts. You know, anybody that's done that, it's very hard to think about the absolute and the spiritual life or mathematics when your finger is burned. Similar process takes place just in terms of our normal life, that we are so focused on this very partial experience of what's real that we lose sight of something larger. So we do see, but we just don't see it all. I had a friend years ago who had somehow been involved in training dogs for to become seeing eye dogs. You know, it's not every day you meet somebody that's into that. But what they described was that probably the hardest part about training an animal to be a guide dog for someone without sight, it wasn't the part of getting them to direct them through traffic or to be able to cross the street at the proper time. The most difficult thing they had to train a guide dog for was they had to train it so that not only did it look out this way, but to train it to look up, to train it to elevate its vision to something beyond its normal sphere was the hardest part of the training. And to me, it's one of those things that for us, we are so deeply enmeshed in the way that we have been trained to see the world and to experience the world, that the world that lies around, within, and beyond this one, we're incapable of even perceiving and would deny its existence. Similar sort of phenomenon occurs, you would probably be aware of this, John, people who ride motorcycles. There are many accidents that occur between motorcycles and cars. And one of the most frequent sort of accidents that occurs is somebody's driving a car and they look in their rearview mirror to see if it's okay to change lanes. They'll look in the rearview mirror, the headlight of the motorcycle is there. The guy riding it is there. But because they're looking and what they're looking to see is a car, it doesn't register that there's something next to them, and they turn into the lane. And countless accidents every year are caused, not because they don't see, but because the training of the mind is such that what they're looking for, they don't see. And so what they do see is invisible to them. It's very strange. But, you know, it sounds strange when we're talking about somebody else doing that. But I share this just because this is the process that moment to moment we're all engaged in. And we're engaged in it in such a subliminal sort of way that it completely escapes us. I mean, here's another example. I'll ask you to do this for me if you would just humor me. If you would just do this, and it's a simple thing, some of you are already doing it. Cross your arms. Just cross your arms in the normal way that you cross your arms. Comfortable? No, it's not. All right, but what I want you to observe is, you know, each one of us, there's a certain left hand is over the right, or the right hand is over the left. They say that there's certain psychological things related to that, but that's not what this is about. They say actually the people with the left hand over are really very dynamic and brilliant and super sexy. And you know, those of you with the right, I don't know what they say about that. But okay, uncross your hands. Now cross them back the opposite way. If you can. Was that something that was... Yeah, if you can do it. It's one of those things that... You can uncross your arms now. But the sensation of trying to do this very simple, very normal act in a different way is something, you know, we are so ingrained in behaviors, in habits, that, you know, the simple act of crossing our arms differently really has to become a matter of thought and attention. With the more profound thing of actually trying to perceive what's real, what's beyond our normal perception, it becomes even more difficult. About 400 or 500 years ago, something started to change in the way that we as human beings value and perceive knowledge. You know, up until that time, the people who had the greatest influence on the affairs of the heart, the affairs of the mind, were people who were, the ones who were looked to, were ones who would be described as wise people. You know, formerly it was the spiritual sort of people, and then it was the religious sorts of leaders. But people of wisdom. And they were often people who had very broad and deep knowledge about a whole variety of subjects relating to human activity. They knew about science, the arts, medicine, you know, spirituality. They were deeply versed in those things. What seemed like very different sorts of currents were something that was harmonized, very present in these sorts of people. Something started to change. And it really started to change with the rise of what has become contemporary science and the worldview that has supported the very dynamic, very rapid growth of science as we view it, as the primary authority in the thinking of humanity. The scientific approach, the scientific method, has had certain advantages that normal religion and spirituality could not claim. I mean, for one thing, it's something that is based on the ability to not only prove something experimentally, but to be able to repeat it. You know, so the same thing that any scientist anywhere in the world does can be repeated, can be demonstrated by any other scientist anywhere else in the world. And so very rapidly, you know, this started to become something where the results were demonstrable. In the spiritual world or in the religious world, it was one of those things where what the demand was is just believe. And, you know, sometime after you die, you know, you'll get the answer that proves what we've been telling you, why you've been here suffering on Earth. So that's something that some people can go for. But a lot of people started to really turn their attention toward this scientific view that started to spread throughout all fields of human endeavor. And without question, it's been something that has been a boon to humanity. But at the same time, there have been some very severe limitations, and it's something that also has kind of created a situation that we now find ourselves that relates to this whole converging moment. Because the view of science as it's practiced and as it has developed, there's a description for how it works. And it has been called not just the scientific approach, but it has been called reductionist materialism is the predominating approach in the scientific communities worldwide. Reductionist and materialist because from the point of view of the practice of contemporary science, everything is reduced basically to the realm of physical phenomena. That's the realm that's tested, that's the realm that's verified, and beyond that, nothing can really be said because the testing ability for anything beyond the physical is not available. So it reduces the realm of reality to the purely physical realm, and then goes on to demonstrate how that works. That's a major diminishment. It also has based itself on this idea that if and when the ultimate sort of smallest particle of the physical realm can be discovered, can be analyzed, then that could provide the understanding for all of the other building blocks that followed. So for a while, the thought was that there was an atom. You know, that once we discover this atom and explore it, that would describe it. And of course, the atom wasn't the smallest thing available. So it's gone more and more subatomic to the point that, you know, now they're saying that perhaps we've reached the ultimate sort of physical particle. But it's had consequences. This whole worldview that submits that everything can be explained in terms of physical phenomena has not just reduced our view of the cosmos, but it's had certain very specific results in how we view our day-to-day world, in how we approach it. I mean, for one thing, in this particular point of view, there is no provision for something that is, you know, pretty much taken for granted, probably by all of us, which is this whole phenomenon of consciousness. You know that we think. We know that we feel. We know that we have had times when we have gone beyond mere thought, beyond mere feeling. But within the scientific worldview, this experience of consciousness is confined to the physical realm. It goes no farther. It's a phenomenon of the brain. You know, certain excitation of molecules within the brain produces consciousness. It's an idea that doesn't work. It's an idea that certainly has cracks in it now, and it's sort of reached the limit of its usefulness. Particularly because now you have experimentation, you know, simple things. up in Wisconsin. I think it's Richard Davidson has done an awful lot of experiments with the whole idea of neuroplasticity of the brain, that the brain is capable of changing its structure. And he has had experiments where he's had people actually practice a very simple meditation form called metta meditation. So the idea that you sit and you sort of cultivate a mind that is loving toward others, that is reaching out in a compassionate sort of sense toward others and yourself. And then they observe what happens in the brain. You know, you're hooked to a whole bunch of sensors. And they have found that this exercise in consciousness changes the physical structure of the brain. And you know, that's just one experiment. So the idea that consciousness is a phenomenon of the physical realm is just not supported anymore. So that's one way that it becomes reduced. By reducing the world to the physical realm, wisdom is reduced to mere knowledge. Values become reduced to facts. And so, you know, the way policies are made is by the comparison of facts. You know, who has the better set of facts? That's the way direction that policy goes into. Beings become reduced to things, separate sorts of entities. There's this continual process of reduction, of separation, of atomization that has become the sort of accepted view and the music that we all dance to. And there are problems with that. You know, you look at something like, and I'm not here to talk about vegetarianism, but in the meat production industry, whatever the product is, whether it's chickens, whether it's beef, whether it's pigs, whatever it is that's being produced for meat, within that industry, it's not described as a chicken. It's not described as an animal. It's described as a unit of production. A unit of production. Which, you know, to you and me, you know, my dog, my cat, I don't ever want to get to the point where I'm regarding it as a unit of production. To me, it is another living thing that moves to the beat of this universal maxim that anything that's alive, anything that breathes, wants to be happy and does not want to suffer. So the capability to continue this process of just reducing, 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 distancing has consequences. And in many ways, the consequences come back to that whole list of issues and problems that I was talking about at the very beginning. What is it, what sort of suppression of a normal and natural instinct to feel compassion for others? Anybody in a family tends to want to provide a situation where their children will be cared for, or their children will have the benefits that allow them to grow into a fuller life. So what is it that allows for this sort of mass point of view that everyone, everywhere, witnesses a certain degradation taking place in those very sorts of gifts that we tend to pass on to the next generation? You know, gifts of environmental health, gifts of all those things. We witness it. We see it. And yet there is some sort of blind spot that allows it to continue because, you know, we have allowed ourselves to become convinced by the various sorts of spins on facts that in some way our knowledge is insufficient. It's a very odd situation. I've heard the expression that we do not know who it is that discovered water. We don't know who discovered water. One thing we do know, it was not a fish. The one swimming around in it, breathing it, the one to whom that's that their total atmosphere, you know, to a fish, it's not water. To a fish, it's, they don't even know, it's just there. You know, what is it? Fishes don't talk about water. We find ourselves in a similar situation. So, you know, what is it that can alleviate that? I mean, really, it's not enough just to talk about problems or convergences. One of the hopeful things that I see, first of all, is that science is actually converging with this view that there is, in fact, a greater life that we all share, and particularly in quantum, in the world of quantum physics. But rather than take time talking about that, what do we do? You know, what do we do to kind of lift ourselves out of this realm of obedience to the voices, the more knowledgeable voices around us? You know, the quote that I used in the little blurb for this was one from a Zen master that said, to the beginner's mind, there are many options. To the expert's mind, there are few. There's only a couple of ways that it can be done to the mind that has been trained into a certain sort of knowledge. But to be able to cultivate a mind that is sufficiently open requires this whole process of moving from the level we have been used to functioning on to some other level. It's a fact that if we're talking about transformation, about some sort of inner unfoldment, information doesn't do it. You know, there is no fact that's going to catapult you into the stages of spiritual awareness. It just doesn't work. Information does not transform, but the light of intuition, the opening to this higher realm that's continually around us, that we all continually function in, is what makes transformation a possibility. So how do we access that? I mean, one of the things I used to like to fly in airplanes, you know, when I used to travel, when it was relatively new to me. To get on a plane and take off was really kind of like a joyful experience. I would always want a window seat to watch the ground, to watch the sky. But one of the things that really used to get me, sometimes you would find yourself taking off on a cloudy day. And, you know, you get on the plane and it's dark. It's dark all around you. It might even be raining. Plane takes off, reaches a point where it just enters into the clouds and you can't see anything. But then at a certain point, it pops through the other side. And when it pops through the other side, it's always the most amazing thing. That this cloudy, sun-absent sort of condition suddenly becomes bright, sunlit. It's always been there. The sun is always shining. The only time it doesn't fall on the earth is when the clouds interfere. For us, we find ourselves in a very similar situation. The field of buddhi, the field of intuition, is continually around us, within us. It's that field that we all share. It's that realm where we all recognize that there are not separations, but there are actually connections among us. But we don't see it. And one of the reasons we tend not to see it is because the Buddhist sort of expression is that we tend to be deeply involved in a process of self-cherishing. I like that way of putting it. That we are so enamored with ourselves and with the process of our thought, maintaining the body, improving it, you know, all the things that we do, feeding it, expressing it, making sure that people recognize that, you know, we're quality people and smart and pretty, all the things we do. That this is like, you know, it's like an automatic, it's a cloud generator. We find ourselves perpetually throwing up clouds, you know, worry, anxiety, so that this light rarely finds its way to us. So one of the things, you know, and it's simple, which is not to say it's easy, but all of those sorts of states of mind that allow us to feel a sense of connection with others are those ones that bring us a little bit closer to this experience, this intuitive, transformative experience of what actually is real. So thoughts that relate to love, connection. Thoughts that relate to compassion. You know, acts that are acts of kindness, friendliness. All of those sorts of things are things that transcend this reductive state of mind that we find ourselves caught in. There's a, you know, for those of you who meditate, there's an exercise. Sounds simple, but, you know, I'd ask you maybe to give it a try. It's a simple thing, and it, like anything, it helps to persist in these things. Probably the thing that a lot of people have an idea, and they talk about what God is or what the divine is. And, you know, there are a lot of ways of describing it, but in terms of the experience that everybody shares, one of the things that seems to most closely, it seems to be a shared perception, which is that no matter what someone's conception of God or the divine might be, that in some way it's very similar to what we would describe as the experience of space. Space is everywhere. Space surrounds us. It pervades us. It defines everything. You know, the space that this body occupies is what you point to and call Tim. I do the same thing. So this kind of perception that space is at least an aspect of the divine, because it always is something that connects everything. Everything exists within space. So perhaps you could try this on some occasion. Normally, when I look at something, or when you do, you look to see the form. So if I'm talking about the chair, what I'm looking at is that blue outline and then the legs. But try to change that way of seeing it. And instead of looking at the chair, try to become aware of the space surrounding the chair. So, or even if you're looking at me, what's the quality of the space between us? You know, can you sense that in the same way that you can focus on an individual form, an isolated form? Sense the quality of the space between us. And then, you know, you look at a tree. Normally we look at the leaves, we look at the branches. But again, there are spaces that actually define what is a leaf. What is a branch? Do you see it? It's an exercise. But it's an exercise that if I think you give it a little bit of time or effort, you might find that sometimes there's an experience that you might have. And often the experience is something along the line of at least a momentary loss of that constant sense of separation. That somehow in this process, you start to become more focused on what it is that unites than what it is that separates. As I say, it's an exercise. But we have to develop ways that are going to be able to lift us out of this particular level to which we have become so trained and so accustomed. Various sorts of gifts that we tend to pass on to the next generation. You know, gifts of environmental health, gifts of all those things. We witness it. We see it. And yet there is some sort of blind spot that allows it to continue because, you know, we have allowed ourselves to become convinced by the various sorts of spins on facts that in some way our knowledge is insufficient. It's a very odd situation. I've heard the expression that we do not know who it is that discovered water. We don't know who discovered water. One thing we do know, it was not a fish. The one swimming around in it, breathing it, the one to whom that's their total atmosphere, you know, to a fish, it's not water. To a fish, they don't even know, it's just there. You know, what is it? Fishes don't talk about water. We find ourselves in a similar situation. So, you know, what is it that can alleviate that? I mean, really, it's not enough just to talk about problems or convergences. One of the hopeful things that I see, first of all, is that science is actually converging with this view that there is, in fact, a greater life that we all share, and particularly in the world of quantum physics. But rather than take time talking about that, what do we do? You know, what do we do to kind of lift ourselves out of this realm of obedience to the voices, the more knowledgeable voices around us? You know, the quote that I used in the little blurb for this was one from a Zen master that said, to the beginner's mind, there are many options. To the expert's mind, there are few. There's only a couple of ways that it can be done to the mind that has been trained into a certain sort of knowledge. But to be able to cultivate a mind that is sufficiently open requires this whole process of moving from the level we have been used to functioning on to some other level. It's a fact that if we're talking about transformation, about some sort of inner unfoldment, information doesn't do it. You know, there is no fact that's going to catapult you into the stages of spiritual awareness. It just doesn't work. Information does not transform, but the light of intuition, the opening to this higher realm that's continually around us, that we all continually function in, is what makes transformation a possibility. So how do we access that? I mean, one of the things I used to like to fly in airplanes, you know, when I used to travel, when it was relatively new to me, to get on a plane and take off was really kind of like a joyful experience. I would always want a window seat to watch the ground, to watch the sky. But one of the things that really used to get me, sometimes you would find yourself taking off on a cloudy day. And, you know, you get on the plane and it's dark. It's dark all around you. It might even be raining. Plane takes off, reaches a point where it just enters into the clouds and you can't see anything. But then at a certain point, it pops through the other side. And when it pops through the other side, it's always the most amazing thing. That this cloudy, sun-absent sort of condition suddenly becomes bright, sunlit. It's always been there. The sun is always shining. The only time it doesn't fall on the earth is when the clouds interfere. For us, we find ourselves in a very similar situation. The field of buddhi, the field of intuition, is continually around us, within us. It's that field that